Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been an experiment with time on WRCT Pittsburgh. Have a great night, folks. Take care of yourselves.
To WRCT Pittsburgh, and this is the stormy weather.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
For those of us who still believe a non-capitalist future is both possible and necessary to save the planet, that there can be no socialism without decolonization. The fact is, the genocide persists precisely because the colonial order is still intact. On a global scale, it just takes on a different form or appearance. And so if we're going to fight and try to build that society, that world, we've got to basically understand that the fight against fascism is a fight against colonialism, is a fight against capitalism.
That's Robin D.G. Kelly, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Robin D.G. Kelly on colonialism, capitalism, and fascism. The era of traditional colonialism, with a few exceptions, is over, but it continues in new shapes and forms to have a profound influence and impact on former colonies all over the world. We are in the age of what may be called neocolonialism. Former colonies are simultaneously independent and dependent. Neocolonialism is a more insidious form of imperialism, in which more powerful countries keep developing nations in a state of economic dependence. This dependent relationship is seen primarily in structural inequality, where the rich countries exploit the resources and labor of the poor. Colonialism fostered and institutionalized racist ideologies that continue to manifest in systemic racism. Robin D.G. Kelly says, "It's important to recognize that the consolidation of the modern colonial state and the rise of the fascist state occurred pretty much at the same time. The modern colonial state and the fascist state are both particular forms of capitalist states." Our guest today is Robin D.G. Kelly. He's professor of history at UCLA, a distinguished scholar, and award-winning author. Among his many books are Race Rebels, Thelonious Monk, and Freedom Dreams. He spoke at the Socialism 2025 conference in Chicago in July. And now, Robin D.G. Kelly, Colonialism, Capitalism, and Fascism.
What I am is I'm a teacher, I'm a professor, I'm a scholar of history. I'm not ashamed of that fact. I'm a better historian than activist, and I will never be, I'll never pretend to be otherwise. And that means that I spend my time and my life trying to make connections and discovering what is hidden, to comprehend the dialectic. And it's what makes me a Marxist, right? What makes me a Marxist is not the emphasis on political economy. It's not the vulgar materialism that passes off as Marxism. And that means that I can't possibly have all the answers or most of the answers. In fact, I also recognize that there are some things for which there are no apparent answers, either because we haven't studied the question deep enough, or the answers will be determined by the history we make, right? We make answers and struggle. I wanted to use this occasion to recognize the 75th anniversary of Discourse on Colonialism, which is this year. And it just happens to be the 25th anniversary since I contributed the foreword to the monthly review edition. So the book has become very popular right now. Discourse, of course, is best known for tracing the roots of fascism to colonialism. You know, Césaire delivers an unsparing indictment of the West, submitting as evidence a litany of colonial crimes in the form of severed heads and ears, genocide, the epistemic violence of consigning entire populations to being nothing more than beasts of burden or occupants of land that belong to the civilized or the chosen according to their God. Fascism was the boomerang, right, of colonial violence striking Europe. And Césaire was not alone in making this case. It was made in versions of it were made by Gandhi, Du Bois, George Padmore, Hannah Arendt, Albert Memmi, Jean-Paul Sartre, among others. And the argument, of course, is not universally accepted, primarily because the definition of fascism is hotly contested still. If I had a dime for everyone who's going to be like, well, is it really fascism? I'd be rich. But it's like this still ongoing thing. And I'm telling you, I'm not interested in debating whether or not what we're seeing from the Trump Heritage Foundation state is actual fascism, neo-fascism, no fascism, something else. I will say this, though. Everyone nowadays quotes Langston Hughes' 1936 speech at the U.S. Congress Against War and Fascism, where he said, fascism is a new name for that kind of terror the Negro has always faced in America. Okay? Right. Thank you. But few people include the rest of the quote, which is, this kind of terrorism is extending more and more to groups of peoples whose skins are not black. Sometimes they mention that. And by the way, the quote's not even complete, but that's the part that's not always there. Now, why is this important? Two reasons. One is obvious. It underscores the need for solidarity. But secondly, and this is the important point I want to make, is that that second sentence, it cuts straight to the problem with the fascism debate. Fascism becomes recognizable in the second sentence. That is, the kind of terrorism is extending more and more to groups of people whose skins are not black, whereas the first sentence is considered not fascism. See, that's a problem. Think about it. That's a big problem. And part of what inspired me to sort of think about this, and even my writing on Césaire and Césaire's own writing, is about that first sentence. Césaire exposes the problem with this split, why Hughes's first sentence also defines fascism and why that matters. I'm not going to linger on the colonial roots of fascism, but I'm going to explore like four things. One, the particular role colonies played in buttressing, so-called classical fascism from the 20s to the 40s, as well as the fascist tendencies or state forms coming from so-called liberal democracies. And part of what I'm going to say is that the difference between fascist and liberal democracies are not that sharp. Okay. Second, the role that colonies play in suppressing class struggle. Third, how black radicals in particular came to see anti-fascism, anti-colonialism as sort of one and the same, and the consequences of not doing that. And then finally, and most critically, Césaire's observation that fascism was not defeated in the Second World War, but flourished by way of ongoing colonial expansion. And so to think about what are the implications for our times. So I will disappoint you if you think I'm going to literally give you lessons about like what anti-colonial struggle might mean for us. There are some lessons, but some things, what I'm really trying to do is understand this relationship in a deeper sort of way. So first, it's important to recognize that the consolidation of the modern colonial state and the rise of the fascist state occurred pretty much simultaneously. Now think about that. Just to avoid some confusion, because there's always confusion, confusion comes with the territory, the modern colonial state, and I mean that modern colonial state and the fascist state are both capitalist states, okay, just particular forms of capitalist states. Modern colonialism is part of a world capitalist system, not solely for the purposes of primary accumulation. And I think Walter Rodney has one of the best quotes about like how he defines fascism, one we don't always use, when he writes in How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, fascism was a monster born of capitalist parents. Fascism came as the end product of centuries of capitalist bestiality, exploitation, domination, and racism mainly exercise outside Europe. And I wish I could talk like Walter, because I mean, if he said it in his Guyanese way, it would be like, he'd be jumping up and down, you know? So with the exception of settler colonies and perhaps India for different reasons, which had a very sophisticated state apparatus before any Europeans showed up, many African colonies did not have a fully functional colonial state until the First World War. This is important, and I know we sometimes take it for granted. We don't think about periodizing colonialism exactly. The point of the colonial state was to create infrastructure for extracting raw materials and produce, but most importantly, to pacify the indigenous population. The colonial state was a coercive state intent on securing territory, crushing opposition, and turning people into peasants and workers. Through what? Through dispossession and enclosure, through systemic taxation, through forced labor, through the introduction of currency for wages and new markets. All colonies had some kind of military force, often made up of indigenous people or settlers, standing police like the Force Publique in Congo. And in fact, during both world wars, according to Walter Rodney, Africa played at least three key roles, right, during the wars. One, to provide a range of raw materials essential for modern arms, and we know this. There would be no atomic bomb without the uranium from Africa. Secondly, to provide bases for European militaries, which it still does. And three, to provide troops and laborers for war. Or to put it another way, European powers use fascism to defeat fascism. The militarization of colonial life, what made colonialism possible, became foundational to the post-colonial state, right? And decades of violence and coup d'etats and military rule are among the consequences. This is not about tribalism. This is not about backwardness. This is not about barbarism. It's about the colonial state being a militarized state. And that's the foundation for so many post-colonial societies. The militarized state is yet another example of the boomerang effect, one that predates formal fascist rule. So Walter Rodney observes in World War I, Germany, it was the commander of German forces in East Africa in World War I who actually was brought back to Germany. He was promoted to general and directed the massacre of German communists in Hamburg in 1918. And Rodney calls this a decisive turning point in German history. For once, the most progressive workers had been crushed. The path was clear for the fascist deformation of the future. Therefore, the state and capital also had to do the work of what? Pacifying and disciplining European workers. This is the era of what? The Russian Revolution, the Mexican Revolution, communists and socialist-led workers and uprisings in Germany and Hungary, Italy, and elsewhere. It was also a period of counter-revolution. And who's behind counter-revolution? That includes social democratic regimes like in Germany. And what does that do? What do? They brutally suppress strikes. They outlawed labor unions. They abandoned democracy and civil liberties under the guise of a state of emergency. What are these? These are the characteristics of fascism from social democrats. Okay, like I'm saying, the distance is not that sharp. And Clara Mattai has this great book called The Capital Order, and she makes a really persuasive case that during World War I and after, working class. And she looks at Italy and the UK. And it also was used to suppress post-war labor rebellions and crush demands for an expanded social wage and to crush socialist dreams. It created a direct path to fascism in Italy. Austerity did. And she writes, austerity embodied the active intervention of the state to reinforce capital accumulation through privatizations, bailouts of financial industrial complexes, monetary deflation, and especially coercive control of labor. Speaking broadly, the nationalist slant of fascist austerity emerges through the sacrifice of the majority for the saving, investing minority, who purported to represent the interests of the whole nation. So we treat austerity as like a tool in a toolbox, as a natural thing. And what she's saying is a weapon, right? And that weapon led to, or opened a pathway for fascism by crushing workers' rebellions. And again, this is in concert with what's happening in the colonies. So in the so-called liberal countries, in this case the UK, it did the same thing, right? Because when it comes to economic policy, there's no democratic means to stop austerity policies. Like, it's not on the vote, right? It's introduced by these people, they call themselves economists. They get paid a lot of money. There's some good economists. I know all six of them, you know? So all these like so-called experts, like technocrats. And of course, there's no input on the part of working people, except how do they input these strikes and labor action? Austerity ultimately prevailed as a new common sense, resulting in a general public acceptance that it was a necessary and neutral tool to weather capitalist crises. Okay, so what about the colonies? What's the relationship? Liberal and authoritarian states shared with varying degrees an ideology of racial destiny and a drive for territorial expansion. Again, notice I'm not making a distinction between like the fascist regimes and the liberal ones. They share all that. These colonial ventures were not just economic, but they inculcated workers with nationalism, generating loyalty and softening the blows of austerity. Workers sacrificed for the nation, right? So imagine the implications of workers buying war bonds. That makes no sense. And yet workers were buying war bonds because they had to be convinced, right, to do the work for their nation, to be part of that nation, to love that nation, right, rather than the workers of the world. Let's take the case of Italy. Like much of Europe, Italy ended the First World War in debt, with high unemployment, wave of strikes and working class insurrections, often led by socialists, communists, and anarchists. The Liberal Party ruled, but was losing power and legitimacy at the end of the war. And it chose, as it was losing its power, to collaborate with fascists. Now, they could have collaborated with the Italian Communist Party, but they made a choice. So how does this translate? Well, it's kind of like the Democratic Party where recruiting Liz Cheney and military leaders, but undermining Mamdani and Sanders and AOC and so on. It's the same thing. The Liberal Party, Democratic Party, right, undermining the left. But Mussolini was not interested in collaboration. Trade unions called a general strike in 1922. The fascists crushed that strike, marched on Rome, and basically seized power. And the Liberal Party at that point capitulated. Now, Mussolini's in power. And what does he do? He sets out to rebuild the Roman Empire, to restore national pride, to recruit workers to support a colonial venture. So in 1935, this is later, Italy invades Ethiopia. And we know that story, but what I want to emphasize is that even before Mussolini, right, Italy had colonized Libya under the Liberal Party following the Italo-Turkish War of 1911. And it was under the Liberal Party, again, you see the parallels with the Democrats, that Italy's occupying forces gassed and starved Libyans, created concentration camps, ultimately killed one-tenth of the population, consistent with all other imperial countries, which waged brutal, often genocidal wars in the colonies. That's France, that's Britain, that's the civilized countries, right? So when Italian occupation forces under Mussolini used mustard gas on Ethiopians in 1935 and killed 250,000 Ethiopians within 3 years of the war, bombed Red Cross hospitals and ambulances. Who does that? Massacred prisoners of war, they did not sharply diverge from the Liberal Party's colonial policies. It wasn't a break. Again, I'm trying to get us to think before we start debating about, you know, should we build an alliance with, and is this really fascism? The line is not that sharp, right? And this, and fundamentally, this is about capitalism and war. You know, another point I want to make is that Western countries were quick to recognize Italy's occupation of Ethiopia as legitimate, and war crimes were ignored until 1940, and that's when, of course, 1940 is when Italy becomes an enemy of the Allies, and they declare war. Otherwise, they would let those crimes go. The invasion of Ethiopia sparked the first stirrings of an anti-fascist movement organized and led by black people. Harlem, you know, they formed the Provisional Committee for the Defense of Ethiopia. Across the country, thousands of black men volunteered to fight. The Garveyite Black Legion established a training camp in upstate New York with 3,000 volunteers. And although Haile Selassie, who's very problematic in other ways, was pressured by the U.S. to refuse volunteers, the point I want to make here, whether they went or not, is that these formations understood anti-colonialism and anti-fascism were intertwined. A year later, you know, a couple years later, depending when they go, black anti-fascists turned their attention to the defense of Republican Spain, joining volunteers. And again, they understood the fight against Franco in Spain as simultaneously striking a blow against colonialism. It was retribution for Ethiopia, and it was a blow against racism at home. But I want to return to this question of the international brigades in Spain to underscore the limitations, even the dangers, of anti-fascism without anti-colonialism. Okay, what do I mean by that? Okay, first of all, Moroccans, under Spanish colonialism, made up a substantial proportion of Franco's armies. African-American volunteers noticed the same Spanish loyalists as Republicans who treated them respectfully, right, if not adoringly, spewing racist vitriol against North Africans, right, because they're on Franco's side. It was not entirely surprising, right, because Spain is a place where school children were learning about, you know, about the age of Moorish domination from the 8th century to the 15th century, about how Christian Crusades saved Spain and the rest of Europe from this heathen menace to civilization, right? So the Islamophobia was deeply embedded there. Besides that, in loyalist posters, North African troops were depicted as extremely dark. They distorted their image in order to portray the Moors as an evil race of people. So black volunteers and black radical intellectuals, unlike the Spaniards and some of the white, not all of them, but some of the white American comrades in the brigades, came to see North Africans as victims of colonial oppression. In other words, they're on the other side of the war, but they're not seeing them necessarily as like fascists. They're seeing them as being recruited and forced to fight on behalf of fascists because they are colonized. And these are black people who recognize this. So Richard Wright, for example, wrote about this. He sums it up this way. He says, the fascists have duped and defrauded a terribly exploited people. Talking about the North African Moroccans. Max and Hughes once again noted the irony of Franco sending Muslim troops on a crusade to rid Christian Spain of communism. Which, think about that, right? And he writes, I knew that Spain once belonged to the Moors, a colored people ranging from light dark to dark white. Now the Moors have come again to Spain with the fascist armies as cannon fodder for Franco. So some radicals called on the Republican government of Spain, the Popular Front, to grant independence to North Africa. In fact, they were saying grant independence to all your colonies under Spanish rule, arguing that such a measure not only had political merit, but it would, in effect, undercut Franco's forces. But they would not. The Spanish government did not. It wouldn't go as far as ending colonialism. In fact, It went further the other way by offering territorial concessions to France and Britain in exchange for Western support, which they really didn't get. The Communist Party of Spain and the PUM, which is the Anti-Stalinist Workers' Party of Unification, believed that an explicit anti-colonial policy might actually foment rebellion within the ranks of Franco's army, but they supported the government's position, and so for the sake of maintaining the Popular Front, they didn't say anything. The Spanish Socialist Workers' Party was outright, we'll never give up the colonies. Like, why call yourself socialists? Like, you know, I'm looking at this. So my point here is that, you know, so many people on the left who are fighting against fascism could not see that the same regime was upholding and maintaining fascism, right, through colonialism. So many international brigaders started calling North African troops, quote, things like the scum of the earth, black riffraff, and mercenaries, to which George Padmore, a black radical, wrote a rebuke in 1938. He says, it seems rather strange that the people who use these epithets conveniently forget that these unfortunate Africans are as much the victims of a social system as Europeans who are forced by sheer economic necessity into the armed forces of the capitalist states and used by the imperialists to shoot down unarmed and defenseless natives in the colonies in the name of democracy and law and order. See, that is the critique right there. Right? So he placed, you know, the blame on the Popular Front government for continuing to hold on to the colonies. And colonialism is precisely what made it possible for Franco to mobilize the army, okay? In any case, the other thing that Césaire was keenly aware of is that fascism was not defeated at the end of the Second World War. So Césaire explicitly references the atrocities carried out by French occupation forces against the anti-colonial movements in Vietnam and Madagascar after World War II as evidence of fascism's persistence. And I just want to quote, he says, think of it, 90,000 dead in Madagascar, Indochina trampled underfoot, crushed to bits, assassinated, tortures brought back from the depths of the Middle Ages. And of course, when he talks about Madagascar, he's referring to the massacre of the Malagasy people by French occupation forces in 1947 during an anti-colonial uprising. And you know who was there to help put down the uprising? Troops from Senegal. We have to know this history. So before the publication of Discourse on Colonialism in 1950, post-war anti-colonial and anti-racist movements insisted that the victory over fascism was incomplete. So, some examples. 1945, this is South Africa, 3 years before the Afrikaner-led National Party came to power and imposed apartheid. The non-European unity movement issued a statement arguing that non-white South Africans continue to live, quote, under a tyranny with very little different from Nazism. And by the way, people in government were themselves Nazis. They weren't like pretend Nazis, they were actual Nazis. Many colonial wars broke out around the time of Discourse's publication. Notice I call them colonial wars. I don't want to call them anti-colonial wars. Why is that? Because by calling them colonial wars, it signals that the instigator of the war were not those fighting for their freedom. They didn't instigate the war, right? They assumed their basic right to freedom in this new global order that says you got a right to freedom. So if they fight back, it's because the war had been waged on them before their birth. It had been waged on them from the moment of the colonial domination, right? Algeria, they wanted to hold on to Kenya. They want to hold on to Vietnam, to the Congo, to Southern Rhodesia, which outlawed all African nationalist parties, and the fascist Rhodesian Front, a party of settlers, won a majority of seats in the legislature when? In 1962, it's the year I was born, 2 years after the Year of Africa. So again, fascists are coming to power, not p- people who look like or sound like, but declare themselves, right, as part of this fascist movement. And there are many more examples, but none in the post-war period is as striking as the creation of Israel.
You're listening to Robin D.G. Kelly on colonialism, capitalism, and fascism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
So Dr. Fayez A. Sayegh, renowned scholar and UN rapporteur, observed in 1970 in an essay the incongruity of the creation of Israel and the expansion of consolidation of settler colonialism, quote, in a historical era marked by universal rejection of colonialism in principle and near total liquidation of colonial empires in practice. So that's the irony. It's like, here's like the latest colonial outpost in the midst of a period that's known for decolonization. So that same year, the same year that French occupation forces crushed the uprising in Madagascar, Zionist militias waged a deliberate campaign of terror and expropriation, razing Palestinian villages, taking or destroying their property, and above all, taking their land. And from 1947 in December to July 1949, militias drove more than 800,000 people, that is 80% of the Palestinian population, from their land, destroyed or emptied over 500 villages, demolished homes, setting some homes ablaze, blowing them up, knowing that families were inside. And I'm not going to repeat the story because you all know that story. But it is worth noting two things. One, the leading settler militias, and especially its leader, David Ben-Gurion, claimed to be fighting on behalf of labor. It was a labor party, the Jewish working classes. The workers, so-called workers' state of Israel, passed laws barring Palestinians' right to return or retrieve their property, which is a very unlaborly thing to do. The man who called himself Zionist Lenin wrote in his diary in 1948 that in their war of dispossession, quote, we need to harm Palestinians without mercy, women and children included. During the operation, there is no need to distinguish between guilty and not guilty. That's what's happening right now. Like the majority of Israelis, Jewish Israelis, have decided that there are no innocents in Gaza, that everyone is good. It doesn't matter. You could be newborn. You're not innocent. And that's what David Ben-Gurion's saying. There's no innocence in our quest to take the land and homes and olive groves and everything. The colonization of Palestine was swift, was violent, it was patently illegal, even by UN standards. And yet, that act of colonization was backed by all Western liberal democracies, those nations that claim to have defeated fascism. Zionism turns the history of Jewish displacement, expropriation, and terror into class rule and colonial violence. So with respect to Palestine, my friend and colleague, Nader Shalhoub Kevorkian, who's one of the most brilliant people on the planet, insists that we recognize dismemberment as a critical feature of colonial violence, not just with respect to the literal body, but in separating people from native and ancestral lands, from plant and animal relations, and therefore from culture, the culture, the memory, the life worlds, and ancestors that tie them there. Expropriation, displacement isn't just spiritual death, but literal death. The process of ethnic cleansing, occupation, the transformation of land into real estate creates killing fields. In her essay titled Ashla and the Genocide in Gaza, Livability Against Fragmented Flesh, which I think everyone should read, theorizes the politics of Ashla, which is Arabic for scattered flesh, a term that she found kids were using in Palestine to describe loved ones, teachers, friends whose bodies were blown to pieces by Israeli bombs and snipers. And she argues that to the colonizer, Palestinian people in Palestine as a whole entity is unthinkable. Their destruction is mandatory. The raison d'etre for Israel's creation as a settler colonial state, not just in whole or in part, but in parts. But Ashlah is also a demand for wholeness, for remembering. She describes breastfeeding women who rushed to the hospital to feed infants whose mothers were turned into Ashlah. She writes, "It is against the production of displaced and shredded corpses that relatives, sons, daughters, fathers, mothers recreate relationships and innovate life. They turn necrophilic settler colonialism upside down when they breastfeed in a genocide," right? Speak of, collect, hold, gather, and embrace Ashlah. That is, in some ways, the dead, the shredded. Dismembering and scattering flesh exceeds extermination. It is overkill, intended for display. It is meant, in her words, to mutilate the killed and turn the killed body into mere flesh, unrecognizable as human, to dehumanize them and their bodies. And this is all being live streamed, right? Now, those of us, and there's a lot of Black people in this room, know, when you say dismemberment, we know exactly what that means. The necropolitics in the United States is what lynching is all about. It's about dismembering the body. They don't just take a life, and they keep it for souvenirs. Rape is also a form of dismemberment, of gendered racial violence, and an assertion of sovereignty. We see this in slavery, right, and it continues well after. Nadra sees the objective behind Israeli sexual violence to invade and violate the intimacy, sexuality, and bodily integrity of the colonized, right? In the production of these slaughtering zones, sexuality, the body, the dismembered wholeness of the colonized are all determined by the sovereignty of the settler state. So, to end this, the Nakba never ended. The violence never ended. The genocide we are witnessing in Gaza today really began in 1948, and like other forms of settler colonialism, it is an expression of fascism, which means the long Palestinian struggle for freedom and self-determination is both an anti-colonial and an anti-fascist struggle. The last thing I want to talk about is the U.S. So Césaire writes, "I make no secret of my opinion that at the present time, the barbarism of Western Europe has reached an incredibly high level, being only surpassed, far surpassed, it is true, by the barbarism of the United States." Now, some of you may not have gotten to the end of discourse, but that's what he says on page 47. Black radical intellectuals in the U.S. were saying much the same thing, but they argued that fascism was on U.S. soil. So it didn't appear as a boomerang, at least not on the surface, since they were talking about homegrown fascism a la Lengths and Hughes. They saw the post-war peace as a ramping up of fascism at home. St. Clair Drake, sociologist and noted anti-fascist and co-author with Horace Caton of Black Metropolis, which is about this city, the landmark two-volume study of Chicago's South Side, published in 1946, right? They were saying that this moment when Black men who had helped defeat fascism were facing unemployment and an uptick in racist violence, they predicted, and I quote, "The Negro may again become a chronic relief client, despised by the majority of white citizens who have to support him from taxes in the symbol around which the aggressions of a frustrated society can be organized so that he may fill the role of," quote, "the whipping boy for an emerging American fascism." And that's what's happening now, right? Such an outcome could be avoided, they argued, so long as the U.S. achieved full employment and the entire world embraced, in their words, a program for emancipating the common man. The problems arise on Bronzeville's 47th Street encircle the globe. A blow struck for freedom in Bronzeville finds its echo in Chongqing and Moscow, in Paris and Senegal. A victory for fascism in Midwest metropolis will sound the knell of doom for the common man everywhere. So they're saying if fascism continues, this is basically the death of all of us. Now, of course, Drake and Caden were skeptical, to put it mildly. Caden writes this opinion piece in the Pittsburgh Courier in 1945 where he told readers, quote, we told readers that military victory abroad did not mean war against fascism was over. And then he writes, we now turn to the war within our own country. Victory for democracy will mean some chance of a peace. Victory for our own native fascism, the Hitler which lives inside of us, or in the nation, will mean that we're setting the stage for the next world war. And his warning was echoed by black communist Claudia Jones, who argued in 1946 in an article that fascism was alive and well in the Jim Crow South, evidenced in part by the revival of lynching in the beatings and assassinations of black veterans. She observes, today the main danger of fascism to the world comes from the most colossal imperialist forces, which are concentrated within the United States. The perpetrators of these attacks are the representatives of the most reactionary section of monopoly capital and of the semi-feudal economy. Replace semi-feudal economy for Silicon Valley, and basically it's the same thing. Okay, so in closing, whether we continue to use the term fascism, you know, I mean, I'm not mad at you if you do or don't. Most of the modern wars and catastrophes that have displaced like over 123 million people today have roots in the vestiges of the colonial order. And I'm arguing that that order is still with us. People deported or detained, indigenous people across the planet perpetually killed by the state and incarcerated in disproportionate numbers, subject to ongoing dispossession, resource extraction, and the violation of sovereign rights and so forth. And by the way, I live in LA. People don't realize that a lot of people being picked up, they're almost all indigenous. Spanish is not even necessarily the first language, right? There's 20 indigenous languages spoken in LA alone. And so these are indigenous people who are being picked up and kidnapped, okay? So that's really, really important to realize. If we think of conjunctures, not as singular moments or periods in a unitary world, but rather multiple overlapping concentric circles, which is the way I think about conjunctures, in a combined and uneven world, then we can talk about a very long colonial conjuncture that is still with us now. And that would mean, for those of us who still believe a non-capitalist future is both possible and necessary to save the planet, that there can be no socialism without decolonization. You cannot have socialism without decolonization. And just to circle back, I mean, you take the question of Palestine. In many ways, there is truth in the assertion that Palestine is the last colonial outpost, the last anti-colonial war. However, that implies that the world is decolonized, and this is not true. The fact is, the genocide persists precisely because the colonial order is still intact on a global scale. It just takes on a different form or appearance. So we look for domination through state forms, but often it takes the form of transnational, multinational, and non-national corporate entities that drive and manage global production of commodities. I mean, who are the beneficiaries of genocidal war? Hewlett-Packard, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and the like. So how different are these from the joint stock companies of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, responsible for colonizing Africa, Asia, and the Americas? What is clear, however, is that the unnamed and unacknowledged colonial violence today is arguably more brutal and more pervasive than the era of high colonialism, you know, of the 19th and mid-20th century. In the 21st century, we are living with more violence, more war, more weapons, more lethal capacity, more military bases, more displacement, more land grabs than a century ago. And if you consider, just pay attention to the Eastern Congo, extending to Uganda and Rwanda, with China providing military support for the Democratic Republic of Congo to protect its own investments in cobalt mining. By most estimates, 7 million people have been internally displaced in Eastern Congo. So the boomerang keeps being thrown back, sometimes with even more lethal force. So we can't just celebrate the boomerang hitting the Europeans because they keep throwing it back. You know, and by Europeans, that's not just Europeans. They're also the BRIC countries. We'll talk about that. I didn't plan to talk about that because I've talked about it before, but, you know, be mad at me if you want to. But there's a rearrangement of power, right? It's still a colonial relationship. And despite, like, 85 years of international law, the UN, all these institutions purportedly designed for world peace in a decolonized world, despite all that, nothing has been able to stop the boomerang permanently. So Césaire writes, the hour of the barbarian is at hand, the modern barbarian, the American hour. Violence, excess, waste, mercantilism, bluff, conformism, stupidity, vulgarity, disorder. Right? So I'm saying that we are living in the American hour, not as a rising empire, but a dying one. Stuart Hall calls it iron times. Gramsci calls it an interregnum in which, quote, morbid phenomena of the most varied kind come to pass. Last thing I want to say is I do think that Césaire's conclusion is fundamentally correct, though we must be precise about what he is saying in that conclusion. I'm not going to read it, but I want you to read it yourself, to recognize that he is speaking of the salvation and not redemption of Europe. So just read a short passage. He writes, the salvation of Europe is not a matter of a revolution in methods. It is a matter of the revolution, capital R, the one which, until such times as there is a classless society, will substitute for the narrow tyranny of a dehumanized bourgeoisie, the preponderance of the only class that still has a universal mission because it suffers in its flesh from all the wrongs of history, from all the universal wrongs, the proletariat. By proletariat, he's talking about sort of global, but here he's specifically talking about the European proletariat because he's talking about the salvation of Europe. What is he saying? He says, it is the European proletariat that's key, not because it is the most advanced, right? Not because it controls the most developed productive forces, but because Europe is an invention founded on racial and gender hierarchy, not unlike the Negro, the savage, and so on. Europe needs to be destroyed, right? And by Europe, Europe's not just that, you know, part of Asia. Europe has actually become a global phenomenon. The proletarian revolution, a true one, must rid itself of hierarchies of human, one of the gifts of a decadent bourgeoisie. It is only then that Europe can free itself and join the rest of the world in the class struggle. And this is what he's saying. Of course, that was the hope in 1950 or 55. That time has passed. But we are in a new time, but we're also in an old one. The colonial conjuncture is still with us. And so if we're going to fight and try to build that society, that world, we've got to basically understand that the fight against fascism is the fight against colonialism, is the fight against capitalism, and we can't be parsing out the places that we think we have to respond to in a state of emergency and the ones that we think are friendly to us that have been killing us the whole time. Thank you. One thing, I'm going to answer it with some sort of definitional terms, but also with questions, and I'll be very, very brief. I mean, we have to think of the state certainly as a historical phenomenon, something Stuart Hall talks about, not a thing or unitary structure, but a set of relationships. And of course, state and state forms long predate capitalism. You know, so what we're talking about is a very specific state form or set of forms that come out of the bourgeois democratic state, right? Or the bourgeois state, or there's a colonial state. The colonial state, the liberal state, you know, the fascist state, and all have much in common. So one question, of course, we have to ask, can we actually in 2025 speak of a socialist state? There's never been, as far as I know, a modern state in any society that was not non-carceral. In other words, all states were carceral. And that's one of the things we have to pay attention to. The socialist states of all, they don't abolish the death penalty. They build prisons. And oftentimes, you know, coming out of the left of, in the 60s and 70s, prisons were sometimes celebrated, right? Firing squads were celebrated. You read the Cuban Revolution and what things were happening what's considered revolutionary violence. Of course, we don't think that way, but the context is very, very important. I think the context for states is always important. Let's talk about council democracy. I'm glad you brought this up, because one of the things that is worth thinking about is that we did have moments of council democracy. In other words, it's not a dream. The Soviets, whether you're talking about, you know, in Russia, whether you were talking about in Italy, they existed. Some amazing democratic practices took place in that immediate, you know, revolutionary moment in Russia, where you have Soviets as big as like thousands of people figuring out ways to work cooperatively, to make decisions collectively. And of course, they were crushed. Why? We know in the case of Italy, in the case of the Soviet Union, it's a little different. I think we can speak of state apparatuses that may be distinct, fractured, and have different functions. And here I'm talking about, I guess I'm being a little bit less abstract and thinking about how we actually interact with the state. Like, what does the state actually mean to us? Sometimes it is the DMV, right? Sometimes it is the very structures that distribute goods and services. That's what it looks like. Sometimes it's actually in the form of public education. The fact that the state is highly contested is, I think, worth thinking about that. The fact that the state is fractured and does different things, that means it's not really the state, although in many ways it's all connected. Yes, there's a coercive arm to the state, but coercion also takes the form of law. We often think of the coercive arm of the state just in terms of police, military, the physical presence of violence, but it's also law. And the state that we're looking at now, the so-called deconstructed state, which is not being deconstructed at all, it's just being repurposed, actually is not only making new laws, but has basically kind of abandoned even the pretense of the rule of law. Okay, and the last things I just want to say is that there are lessons to be learned from history. I know. I mean, that's what I do for a living. There are many places for us to plug into different practices and projects that are beyond the state. And I just want to make a plug for one, Sweetwater Foundation, which is right here in Chicago, which is organizing beyond the state, providing food, organic food, skills. They build, they grow, they teach. And they're right here in Chicago. Emmanuel Pratt, Gia Pratt, they're creators. And so there's so many spaces that we cannot abandon in our sort of panic, right? Which we can't panic. You know, if you've watched enough Twilight Zones, you know you can't panic. You know, you have to basically keep straight focus, and that's, I think, what we need to do.
You were just listening to Robin D.G. Kelly on colonialism, capitalism, and fascism. He spoke at the Socialism 2025 conference in Chicago in July. Robin D.G. Kelly, a professor of history at UCLA, is a distinguished scholar and award-winning author. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Winona LaDuke, Azad Issa, Claudia de la Cruz, Vijay Prashad, Chris Hedges, Gabor Mate, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Robin D.G. Kelly on Colonialism, Capitalism, and Fascism, and for Eduardo Galeano's classic book, Open Veins of Latin America, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Thelonious Monk. Bye-ya.
Fact is that algorithms are the underlying technology of missile defense. Algorithms happen to be the perfect weapon for executing commands in real time to automated weapons over huge expanses of geography. Algorithms, which were shaped for war, now shape civilization writ large. Digital technologies blur any distinction between civil society and a military state that may have existed.
That's Kuhan Pakmander, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Kuhan Pakmander on algorithms, digital technologies, and warfare. Algorithms, the dictionary tells us, are a process or set of rules to be followed in calculations or other problem-solving operations, especially by computer. Sounds innocuous enough, but hang on, it has a dark side. Algorithms can make mistakes due to biases, poor design, coding errors, or flawed assumptions. They can collect and process large amounts of personal data, which can put people's privacy rights at risk. And there are lethal dangers. Kuhan Pakmander warns the algorithms that missiles have spawned have been a scourge on Mother Earth and our own humanity with our smartphones, satellites, robotics, and AI, and all the rest. Through which civil society has unwittingly become militarized through and through. Our guest today is Kuhan Pakmander. She's a journalist, author, and peace and environmental activist. Her articles appear in The Nation, The Progressive, Foreign Policy in Focus, and other publications. And now, Kuhan Pakmander.
Our nation, the United States of America, continues to bankroll two horrible wars. One, an off-the-rails genocide in Gaza that has expanded into Lebanon, and the other one, a brutalization of Ukraine.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The little ones, they scream. We are used to the sound of shelling, to the sound of gunfire. We are used to it. It has become the norm, but the little ones, I cannot bear seeing them like